current session is entitled Green Gentrification, Enough is Enough. That's where you intended to be. You are here. You have arrived. You are the catalyst for change in this super important topic around urban forestry, urban greening, conservation planning, and doing it in a way that is respectful of people and place. We have some really amazing speakers lined up for you this morning. I'll introduce them real quickly and then get out of their way. First, I'll introduce Cindy Blaine. I think many of us know her as the leader of California Relief. She'll be moderating this session, our great panel up here. Next to her is Enrique Huerta, community organizer with From Lot to Spot, and Emmy Wang, environmental equity manager from the Green Lining Institute, and last but not least, Dr. Winifred Curran, who is associate professor and chair of the Department of Geography at DePaul University. They'll be speaking from a number of perspectives and a number of scales on the issue of green gentrification. Many thanks to them for showing up today. Many thanks to you for showing up today. And I think I was supposed to introduce myself too. And I'm like, why is this lady up here talking to us about green gentrification? So Dana Coelho, currently Alliance Director of the Metro Denver Nature Alliance, organization a long time in coming, but just recently founded. We're a group of groups focused on equity, focused on nature-based conservation and programming throughout the Metro Denver area. So this is a topic really close to my heart as well. Prior to joining the Alliance, I served for several years as the Urban and Community Forestry Program Lead for the Rocky Mountain region of the U.S. Forest Service. So longstanding partners in community forestry partner, really, really psyched to be here and part of this conversation this morning. Thank you.
Hi, can you hear me? Okay, this is a 35-minute session. We're going to talk fairly quickly. We have about 5 minutes each, and because we want to be able to get to some questions and answers and input from you guys at the end. We wanted to make this interactive, but we only had 35 minutes, otherwise we would have taken 2 hours. So really excited to have everybody here. Everybody was in the other room when you were asked if you'd heard of green gentrification, so I'm not going to ask that. I'm going to ask, have any of you been accused of green gentrification? Raise your hand. Okay, so I don't know how, for the people that aren't in the room, it's a really weird feeling when you're sitting there talking to people about what you do, and you talk about that you do trees, and suddenly they say, but you're causing green gentrification, and your immediate thing is, whoa, wait a minute, you know, that's above my pay grade, I don't do that, I just plant trees. And then I realized that you can't just back off from this. The reason we wanted to have this discussion is so that you're better prepared to respond when this comes up. And we're going to talk about scales. I think the other thing I wanted to mention was, so I operate at the state level. Wynn is research, of course, across the country. Emmy's with the Green Lining Institute. For those of you who are not from California, they're one of the premier environmental justice groups operating at the statewide level as well. And then Enrique is working From Lot to Spot here in LA, taking vacant lots and turning them into gardens or adding greenery. So he's operating at the local level. So that's what our levels are. So how do you respond effectively to this? This issue is such a big deal in California. You've all heard about all of our wonderful cap and trade dollars. Well, that means that there might be an unintended consequence that we're investing all this money in underserved communities, and what's going to happen? It's become such an issue or brought to the attention of the people in California that there is now a project at UC Berkeley called the Urban Displacement Project. Examining the unintended effects of climate change mitigation investment-related displacement. That's a long mouthful, saying cap and trade money. Focusing on 3 regions, Bay Area, Los Angeles, and Fresno. So they'll estimate the relationship between displacement pressures and California's climate mitigation strategies. So you can go check out that website. One of the other things that I'd read somewhere too was that when they've done some of the studies of displacement, what they've seen is that if you talk low-income white people versus low-income people of color, when there is displacement, low-income people of color are affected much, much more. And I don't understand the science behind that, but that's one of the realities. I'm going to brief through. So these are the people who are going to talk today. You're here to talk about the issues, to learn a bit about the vocabulary. Anytime you go like to a foreign country or you start a new job, you have to learn the vocabulary. So we're going to talk about what the words are. I think even beyond the vocabulary is some of the emotions. I have seen real interesting, like, treat people get super defensive, like I did. I've also seen people get really mad and say, well, if they don't want our trees, then we're not going to give them trees. And then I think the other emotion that comes into play is fear. And that came up in one of the last sessions, that let's just be honest, the urban forest world is usually or has historically been white middle class. We've talked about that in other sessions. And you're working in communities that are not middle class and they're not necessarily white. And so, as somebody said to me, when I see a sign that there's been road improvement, that's a good thing in a middle class neighborhood. Well, if you're living in a less well affluent neighborhood, that might be a sign of change, and that means fear is inspired. So we have to recognize that emotion and not feel that we can dismiss it when somebody says, oh, your trees are going to make changes in our neighborhood. They will. As John said, there is that feeling, and it's been documented, that the really big, big projects, like the High Line, are the ones that are going to make that change, not necessarily us just going in and planting a few trees. As a matter of fact, that's why there's the title of our group, Just Enough is Enough. Wynn's going to talk about how her research led to her expression about just green enough. And yet, when I first heard that expression used by another researcher, I thought, just green enough sounds like we're not giving you diddly. So that didn't sound good. But Wynn's going to clarify that. And the last thing I wanted to say was, when Wynn was talking on the phone with us, I'm paraphrasing her, but saying there is a big difference between environmental benefits and luxury development. So with that, I'll introduce Wynn.
Thank you for organizing this session, because it's great that we're talking about this now, right? This is something that gentrification researchers have been looking at for a number of years, and it's great to see it kind of get down to the policy level and the practitioner level so that we can actually do something about it. So first, I'll just start out with the definition of gentrification, because I think often a lot of the confusion about what we're talking about is confusion over what that term means. And why those of us who do research on it consider it to be a negative thing is because, as you'll see from the definition I put up here, physical upgrading that results in the displacement of working class residents and other users, is that displacement is inherent to the process of gentrification. You'll see some often in the press or some policymakers often refer to their desire to accomplish gentrification without displacement. Well, if there's no displacement, then it's not gentrification, right? Then it's urban development, it's, you know, revitalization, it's, you know, any other host of vocabulary words we could use. But the sore point with gentrification is that it is about displacement. And so that happens, and I also just want to clarify again, kind of, since I'll be talking about the strategy that my co-author and I, Trina Hamilton, called Just Green Enough, and thanks, John, for the shout out earlier this morning. It was actually Trina who came up with the phrase Just Green Enough, credit where credit is due, is that first of all, I am not going to argue, nor would any other researcher on environmental gentrification argue, that trees gentrify, right? It's not the trees. The trees are not the problem. The problem is a landscape of uneven development where some neighborhoods get lots of resources and other neighborhoods get very few. And so the problem is that we ever have a neighborhood that has the experience in that picture on the left. That picture is from a neighborhood in Chicago called Pilsen. That's an overwhelmingly Mexican neighborhood. It's long been a port of entry immigrant community. The plan for it, so those train tracks, those abandoned train tracks that you see, are planned for two trails project called El Paseo. El Paseo has not been built. There is not a blade of grass. Not all of the land has been obtained by the city yet. No design exists. And already real estate developers are advertising property as being on El Paseo. Right, so it's not even the actual fact of green that gentrifies. It's just even the promise of green that can gentrify, that can cause these spiraling up of real estate prices, again, in the context of this massive landscape of disinvestment, and also this landscape of, you know, every speculator and developer looking for the next frontier, right? What's going to be that next hot neighborhood? And so greening can be one of the indicators that this is going to be the next hot neighborhood, right? So that's the problem. And the picture on the right is planned for one development. It's going to be an upgrade manufacturing to high-end office space along El Paseo, but not technically the plan itself. But so the fact that, you know, look at the profit potential in the difference between those two pictures, right? That's what's driving gentrification. That's what gentrification is. So environmental gentrification is basically sort of an upgrading of original gentrification, right? The gentrification for many years focused on housing. Once kind of that was complete, then we started looking at the retail landscape, started looking at declining industrial areas. And so then kind of the next frontier there was looking at areas that needed cleanup, where some sort of greening or remediation could make a neighborhood that had been considered kind of a no man's land in terms of investment, all of a sudden ripe for some kind of reinvestment, right? The greening can help to accomplish that work. And so I'll let you read the definition at your leisure of environmental gentrification from Melissa Checker, who's at City University of New York. But what's so sort of pernicious about environmental gentrification is that a lot of the projects that end up being environmental gentrification use all the language of environmental justice and sustainability and resilience to accomplish very unequal things on the ground. So again, here the picture is from the High Line in New York City, which is the ultimate example of environmental gentrification, which, again, a rails to trails project, that when it was completed, real estate prices in the surrounding area went up 103%, right? So this is no accident. And so in order to sort of prevent that thing from happening, again, my colleague Trina Hamilton and I came up with a strategy called Just Green Enough, which looked at, this picture is from the Newtown Creek Nature Walk. And Newtown Creek is the body of water that separates Brooklyn from Queens from New York, and it's one of the most polluted waterways in the country. It's a Superfund site. And this project looked at why the Superfund site had been declared when it was. So after a 50-year-old oil spill, why does cleanup happen in the 2010s? And we thought it would be a classic case of environmental gentrification. And instead, what we found was a group of long-term community residents and environmental activists working with in-movers, working with gentrifiers to come up with a different vision, right? That when some of the gentrifiers realized exactly how polluted the area was, they felt real sympathy with the long-term residents and worked together to come up with a vision that would accomplish the environmental goods without the luxury development. And so key to that plan in this neighborhood has been preserving the industrial manufacturing zoning of the area. But the idea is behind Just Green Enough, and again, this is not necessarily a blueprint that can be rolled out the same way in every place, except to say that every community has a vision for what their environmental improvement looks like, right? For what sort of environmental amenities they want to have. Let's actually listen to them rather than taking the picture of, you know, the High Line or the 606 that John mentioned this morning as well, and just rolling that out in cities across the country, right? Listen to communities. Understand the history of environmental injustice and other disinvestment that's happened to these communities, and think very intentionally about ways to serve them so that the very people who, again, as John mentioned, are organizing for the environmental improvements then don't ever get to enjoy them because they've been displaced because of rising real estate prices. And I think that's my time. So.
We were trying to mingle our slides, and there was just a couple of the terms that I wanted to bring up, because you have to know the territory with the terms. So displacement, eviction, tenant protections. I mean, you guys work in trees. How many of you ever thought about tenant protection? Anti-displacement policies, rent control or stabilization, inclusionary zoning incentives. All the ones that have asterisks up here need to be done in cahoots with the city or the municipality. The one that I have in bold at the bottom is community land trusts, and I just wanted to bring that up because you should know about that. How many people have heard of a community land trust? Okay, good. And I'm not going to talk about it too much, but the other place that's happening is because of California cap and trade having the concern of displacement, there's a grant called Transformative Climate Communities, which is a multi-grant project where they go in and they do everything. They do urban forest, they do urban greening, they do electric vehicles, they do other things, weatherization. Those are big projects. They put together
in their guidelines this checklist of what you should do to have an anti-displacement plan. And that's going to be one of the resources at the end so that you can figure, you can use it as a resource yourself. Community Land Trust is where you have a group that gets together, and instead of going out and buying land in the boonies, you're buying land in a city, and that land is owned by the trust, but then they sell houses for reasonable prices on top of that land. It's kind of weird. People will own the house, they can build equity in the house, but the fact that the property is owned by the trust means that it won't ever be sold to a rich hipster. I was going to say yuppie, but that would have dated me. And there's some examples. There's one in San Francisco, that's the Columbus Avenue one, and then right here in LA we have the Los Angeles Neighborhood Land Trust, which is actually about green spaces. It's not about houses, it's about green spaces in underserved communities. So, sorry, jumping back to Emmy. Here we go.
Right. Thanks for that. I'm a little shorter. Hi, everyone. Good morning. My name is Emmy Wang. I'm with an organization called the Greenland Institute. And I'm going to kind of pick off where, kind of hone in on kind of some of the things that Winnie was talking about, right? So first is kind of reminding ourselves of definitions and history, right? Gentrification, by definition, has to occur, means the process of the transformation of formerly working class and low-income neighborhoods being transformed by higher-income residents. What that means is gentrification has to occur in places of disinvestment. So I want to talk to you a little about why we have the context of disinvestment. Why are some of our neighborhoods more well off, and why have some of our neighborhoods been disinvested? And the reason is American history and decades of exclusionary policies that created the ways in which our neighborhoods, and particularly the racial and class makeup of our neighborhoods look. Policies like racially exclusive covenants, blockbusting, redlining, suburbanization, highway construction, all these policies contributing to the ways our communities look and feel today. So I want to hone in on just one of those policies, which is redlining. I work in an organization called the Greenlining Institute. We're a policy and advocacy organization based here in California. And greenlining is essentially a made-up word to counter the practices of redlining. And what we do is we try to proactively invest in communities of color. And so just to ground us a little bit in the history, what we're looking at here are maps created starting in the 1930s by the Federal Housing Administration and the Home Owners Loans Corporation, centered around mortgage lending. And so what these maps essentially did is outline the risk of different neighborhoods for mortgage lending. And you'll see that the neighborhoods in red, those were neighborhoods that essentially these maps advised banks not to lend to. And the number one kind of factor in terms of whether a neighborhood was deemed in the red, whether a neighborhood was deemed unstable, was class and ethnic kind of homogeneity and composition. So communities that had, you know, even a couple, mostly black and brown families, were deemed in the red and then systematically disinvested in and kind of segregated, right? So that becomes a black and brown neighborhood. And if you know anything about, you know, Oakland, Portland, Atlanta, and New Orleans, you know that these maps correspond to how these neighborhoods look today. I'm based in Oakland, and so you can see East and West Oakland are the neighborhoods in red over here. Those are the neighborhoods that today are still kind of really struggling, still black and brown, but also confronting the specter of gentrification. So the question when it comes to planting trees and greening up our neighborhoods, that we know that these investments are needed for our communities, but in a context of disinvestment, in a context of long-standing historical practices, how do we green up our communities in a way that feels, in a way that tries to avoid displacement as much as possible? So the answer for us, and the answer for me, is community control, and also embedding social equity in kind of every aspect of your project. And by social equity, a quick definition is the fair and just distribution of societal benefits and burdens. So this morning we heard a lot about equity. We are hearing more and more equity is a buzzword. But I think one of the things that we're also seeing is that it's become used so much that the term loses meaning, right? And you hear equity kind of proclaimed in the mission and vision of something, but then it's never carried through, and we call that equity washing. So we've developed a framework, which we call operationalizing equity, and here's a super boring PowerPoint slide on it, but essentially it's how do you operationalize equity in your projects and in your work? And for us, it means equity has to be in all of these places, right, from start to finish. So starting at the top, equity has to be considered, anti-displacement has to be considered in the mission and vision of your project. And more than that, it has to be really explicit, kind of publicly stated in your statement, so that everyone else who's working in a project understand that that's a value, so it doesn't just reside in, you know, the couple people leading the project, right? The next step is the planning process, right? Who is involved in decision making? How are you reaching out to community members? In neighborhoods where folks don't speak English or where folks have distrust, legitimate distrust of institutions, how are you bridging those divides and how are you uplifting community leadership? The third piece is the programs, the projects, and services, right? In the outcomes, how are the anti-displacement measures that you've implemented looking? How is equity embedded into your programs? How are you addressing priority needs of the community? And then lastly is the analysis and measurement. I think this is the piece that the field in general has been really struggling with, which is, how do you measure equity progress, right? What are you looking at specifically on equity?